Greetings, everyone. You're with Norm Schultz, Chalmer Wren, and I'm Nick Urkus. This is the Mile High Sanity Project, and you're in it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Mile High Sanity Project. Once again, we are here to talk about Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. This is episode 3, and if you're following along, I hope you're enjoying the series as much as we are here. This episode, When Knowledge Conquers Fear. And I'm here with Norm Schultz.
Good morning.
I'm here with Chalmer Wren.
How's it going?
Fantastic. And this episode really was one of it told this tale of one of the most important times in human history here, a transitional period between kind of being ruled over by ignorance and fear and really the birth of the modern science era. And it's amazing to think of how close that came to not happening. And yeah. I didn't know about this.
Yeah.
You know, arguably one of the most important books written in science is Sir Isaac Newton's Principia Mathematica. Mm-hmm. It was a game changer. It's up there with The Origin of Species. And it almost didn't happen. And an unsung hero who not a lot of people know about other than the name of his comet brought that to us.
Yeah.
And that was Edmund Halley. And Norm, last week you talked about gaps in the knowledge of what we know. This is a good one. This is a big one for me.
Yeah.
I just didn't know much about Edmund Halley at all.
And, you know, before we get into talking about the details of the show, I just want to say that I think the show has definitely hit its stride.
Oh, yeah.
I'm enjoying it a lot more than the first episode. And, yeah, like you're saying, people who are – it's got something for everyone. Now it's got things that science-minded folks – already know, but we're learning new stuff as well.
Right. We were wondering if we were going to get some out of it. I mean, I got a ton out of this episode.
Yeah. And the full range. You can be an expert and still enjoy the show now, I think. You can be a novice and still enjoy the show because of the way it's presented. Mm-hmm. They're doing a great job. I'm really enjoying it.
No, and, you know, I liked the metaphor of, you know, it opens up with, like, you know, like the little baby, and it's just looking up at the stars, at the cosmos. And Neil says, we're born into a mystery, like an abandoned baby. And that really, it took me back to the first episode, actually, with the cosmic calendar, where they talk about all of recorded human history is like the last 14 seconds or something on the cosmic calendar.
Right.
And modern science is like 1 second ago that
yeah.
that started.
Yeah.
So we really are still infants in this.
As a side note, 15, 20 years from now, somebody's going to be saying, I was that kid.
I know. So lucky.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, pick me up.
Chalmer, did you know much about Edmund Halley, or was this something that you didn't know about as much going into it?
No, a lot of this was news to me. I mean, I knew about the impact of Newton's work, but not really the historical context.
How about your bird? Ask your bird how much it knew about Edmund Halley. And no,
okay. well informed.
Oh. just not able to vocalize.
Kind of a dick about it.
Yeah. Bird brain is very misleading. It's actually very smart.
Really pushy. I didn't talk about it much with them.
Well, they get so repetitive.
Yeah. Well, the Indeed. Episode kind of opens talking about the era that we were coming out of, and when this transition happened was one where, despite our best efforts in some cases, we just didn't have good explanations for things scientifically that we could see with our own observations, things that we could observe. We had no way of explaining what we were seeing.
Right, but we as a species had a trait
right.
that was both something helpful and potentially deceptive, the yep. pattern recognition trait.
I made a note of that too.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
As Neil deGrasse Tyson pointed out, that it carries obvious advantages to an organism trying to survive the planet.
Right.
You can tell the difference and remember the difference between things that are poisonous or not, things that are dangerous and not. You can, you know, know when you're about to come up upon a stream so you can get water. You can recognize that audible pattern. It's not just visual, right?
Right. No, yeah.
So that is something that's obviously a good thing, but it can lead you to see patterns in things that aren't really there.
Yeah, false pattern recognition.
Sure, which, you know, I don't think he actually uses the word, and sometimes the word is pareidolia. That is a word that I think the skeptic community has arrived on. I'm not sure the origin of the word.
I think pareidolia refers specifically to patterns in visual.
Yeah.
He does mention that, not by name, though. He talks about seeing, like, you know, a message in
right.
bread and toast.
Yes.
Michael Shermer tried to coin the term patternicity. I don't know if it ever caught on, though.
With the believing brain, I mean, that was something we talked about before. Yeah. This whole book was about the kind of consequences of, like, false pattern recognition, you know, and how there is that evolutionary advantage.
Right. But I think the show doesn't emphasize that too much. It says basically that, you know, very early on, people noticed a pattern in the stars.
Right.
That things that happened on Earth were correlated with certain star patterns, and that itself is a pattern, and this was helpful to them. They could judge the seasons and do some navigation, things like that. So that was his segue, I believe, into...
Right. It's kind of interesting to me to think, like, going back before people knew, like, imagine looking up at the night sky, having no context, having no depth, no previous bias as to what you're seeing. People must have just been sitting out there for like 200,000 years thinking, what the fuck is up there?
Right.
Well, actually, I'm not sure I agree with you. I think that they just probably thought that it was part of their religious system and dismissed it. They might have looked at it because of its beauty, but I don't think – I think one of the things that's dangerous about religious thinking is that it leads people to not asking that question, what is that, right? Mm.
Maybe, although I don't know if they dismissed it as much as they thought they knew what it was.
Right.
I mean
– Yeah, yeah.
Christopher Hitchens always says, as much as we criticize religion, one of the things that we have to realize is that it was our first attempt to understand the world.
Sure.
And it's he always used to say it's the worst because it was the first.
Right.
You know, and I liked how they transitioned to, you know, people who saw, like, you're used to seeing that unchanging sky, to you anyways. And,
right.
And then you look up and you see a comet all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Something now, different. Now I'm with you, Chalmer. They must have definitely said, what the fuck is that?
And this is something I think I knew at one point, but I forgot.
They panicked.
Right. Well, the word disaster, the Greek word disaster, means bad star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and that's interesting.
Yeah, I have my notes. A comet. Oh, no. Bad shit. The gods are angry.
Yeah.
The show makes the point that every culture basically saw it as a bad omen.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And now I thought that was interesting. And when they were going over to the various cultures throughout the world and what they all saw it was, it was never cool shit's coming. It was always not good, not as good. So, yeah. And from there, they kind of, you know, they kind of pull out and they talk about the Oort cloud. And they talked about this a bit in the first episode. This is, you know, it's I thought that was a cool segue to kind of talk about, you know, where are these comets coming from?
Right.
You know, and I also thought it was very telling, something I agree with, like Neil says, we all know the names of, like, mass murderers, and we can just, like, rattle those off, but someone like Jan Oort,
mm-hmm.
no one even knows who he was.
Right.
And
kind of a cool name. I'd like to have Oort as my last name. I think that's just a cool last name. I wonder what it means.
Well, I don't know.
It's cooler than either one of you guys' last name.
Well, yeah, it's true.
It's true.
That's why I don't discover clouds, because they're like, why don't you let someone else with a better name to do it? And I'm like, you're right. I defer.
No, I don't know. The Arcus cloud. That's decent.
That's true.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I need to find a cloud now.
Yeah. The Wren cloud, that just sounds threatening.
Right.
A little bit, like a herd of angry birds.
Yeah.
Right. A murder, if you will.
Schultz cloud. That's just a shitstorm right there.
Right. Yeah.
Mein home.
that's death. Well, we don't know much about Jan Oort. And what really, I think the interesting point that was made in the show was that he predicted the cloud of objects. And we can think, you know, someone working in the, you know, what, 1900s?
Yeah.
Someone working back then to determine this large astronomical body, we can relate to the idea that he might not have ever seen it.
Well, no one has.
Right, but that's the point. Actually, nobody has ever seen the Oort cloud, and to this day, and no one could ever see it.
I like Neil saying, like, it's dark out here. You know, like we can't see it. And well, also, no, your closest neighbor is as close as Earth to Saturn.
Right, so the objects in the Oort cloud because of the expansive size of a sphere, once it's that far from the sun, the objects in the cloud are tremendously far away from each other. So there is no perspective upon which you would actually be able to see this. Because if you were far enough to see it as a cloud, well, the objects would be too small.
Right.
And if you were too close, then they would be too far away to see them as some coherent body of things. So it's a speculative kind of statement about these objects. But it's known because of the calculations that can be done. And this is this is part of science that I think people do have a hard time understanding, and that they only want to believe in things that they can see. I've ran into people who have questioned, for example, the existence of, you know, the electron, because, well, we'd never seen an electron, things like that. Science doesn't really work that way. You know, seeing something is not the definitive be-all of existence.
I hear this a lot from creationists and trying to challenge evolution and history, that you weren't there to observe it. And talk about missing the point.
Right.
You know, that's not what they really mean by that.
Yeah, I think I've seen in a video where Ken Ham encourages people,
yeah,
when they talk about things being very, very old, to just say, were you there?
Yeah, exactly.
And what I've always thought is, you know, that's what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If a religious person ever wants to talk about Noah, I can ask, were you there?
Right.
And you
would think so, but they're like, it's in this book, so.
Right.
Or you could just insist that you were there. Right. And you know, if you're going to argue with somebody crazy, you might as well just join them.
You might as well just go all in.
Nothing they're saying is any less crazy, so.
Gotcha.
You're like, I am Noah. Yeah. From there, they kind of transition. I mean, they talk about one of the things that we know about the Oort cloud is that's probably where most of the comets that we see come
from.
Right. And
there's someone in there flinging them at us.
That's right. Well, you know, God's like, here we go. Another one.
Yeah.
Hail Bob.
Yeah. I actually thought that that would be a neat science fiction premise, that some alien species, instead of revealing themselves, they attack a planet by just flinging asteroids at it.
Mm. It's kind of like that in Starship Troopers.
Really?
Yeah. They send an asteroid that hits us.
Huh.
Bug plasma. What kind of nerd are you?
I'm sorry. I don't know if I ever actually saw Starship Troopers, because it was
kind of classic, even though it's definitely a B movie. I still recommend it.
Right.
It's self-aware, though.
Yeah. It was very self-aware. I mean, this is also something they do in the series Babylon 5. One of the alien races, when they're at war with another one, they do something that's like illegal in the galaxy, which is bombarding a planet with asteroids.
Huh. Okay.
It's like, well, against interstellar rules.
My geek cred is going down right now.
That's okay. That's okay. We'll get it back. We'll get it back.
Yeah, I have my notes that in the Oort cloud, the orbits of these asteroids and I guess would-be comets is about a million-year orbit. It takes that long for them to go around the sun once.
Which is crazy. That is
crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that some of the evidence they had of the Oort cloud was the amount of asteroids and comets that we can see, and how, you know, the time frame it takes for them to orbit the sun like that, we know there must be a source feeding it.
Right.
So even though it's one of those things where in science, even though you can't always directly observe things like the Oort cloud, there still is observational evidence that usually supports these things.
One day we'll be able to observe the individual objects, and then you just continue that process and build the cloud that way. But, you know, that'll be a long way away. I don't think that they can detect objects that far out, right?
I don't think so.
I think that the objects in the Oort cloud tend to be too small.
Yeah. Too small, too far away.
I mean, you get much smaller than Pluto, I think it's harder.
I think we just found a new dwarf planet beyond the orbit of Pluto in the Kuiper Belt, and it I have it right here, and it's a big one, and, you know, we've been looking, and we just found it. Hmm. Well, it's 280 miles across, but
that's pretty damn small.
Yeah.
But imagine you double or triple that distance
out there,
out into the Oort cloud, you have smaller objects even.
Right. For something that is be considered a dwarf planet, I consider that pretty small.
Yeah.
Well, it's dwarfism. I mean,
but now they think there may be a planet larger, even further out.
would make sense. I mean, you know.
Sort of stuff wouldn't surprise me. And, you know, from here, the episode kind of takes us into our hero story of this weekend.
But I got to say something before then, because there's a scene right before then where he's traveling out in the ship.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's talking about the ship of the imagination, and it accelerates with Neil deGrasse Tyson in view. And I noticed, this is totally a off-the-wall comment, but I noticed that the chair on the ship does not look at all comfortable.
Mm.
Did you guys see that? It's a very, like, rectangular, looks like metal chair.
True, but I can imagine it being comfortable, and it is an imagined ship, so... That's really all that matters.
Well, if he's going to take such long trips, you know, get a Lazy Boy or something.
That'd be so much funnier if he just had like a really comfortable Lazy Boy, like recliner, like, like potato chips while he's watching the comment.
That would make more sense considering the times involved to get there. But I guess the ship of the imagination.
Like pork rinds on his shoulder. Like,
Can the ship of the imagination travel faster than light? I would guess so.
It could do anything.
The ship of the imagination.
Yeah.
That's not fair.
Our imagination has an unfair advantage. Advantage humans.
Anyway, the next time you see the show, take a look at the chair. See if you concur with me.
I thought that scene was well done. I thought it was cool with you know, them zooming in on him and following the comet all the way in. Yeah. They do cool things like that. You know, I thought that this was going to be the hero. It's kind of a dual hero, I suppose, to talk about this time. But I thought it was going to be all Isaac Newton.
Right.
And I know that, you know, Neil has said before that I think that's his favorite scientist in history. Like the most important one, you think.
I have in my notes, every time I write his name, I just write Isaac fucking Newton, because the guy was crazy.
You almost have to.
It's just incredible the stuff that he was able to do.
Yeah. And well, what's insane to me is that the kind of insecurities that he had, he almost didn't publish his shit. And it was such game-changing important stuff.
Yeah.
And it took Edmund Halley to do it, to bring him out there. And I got to be honest, like Edmund Halley was someone who I knew, obviously, about. Everyone knows about, like, you know, Halley's Comet, like that. And beyond that, though, my knowledge of him, I didn't really even understand. I don't think I knew the time era he lived in.
Right.
I just didn't. And so whenever I heard that he hung out with Sir Isaac Newton, I kind of had a scientist nerd out. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Someone like two great scientists living together in that same time era. That kind of stuff is cool.
Yeah.
To me, like we talk about in some of our ethics series about, you know, did someone like David Hume ever get the bump into Immanuel Kant?
Right.
This is like two major scientific minds who are buddies.
Yeah. I mean, I have in my notes that I think one of the themes of this episode is that science is about competition, collaboration, and, you know, trying to get things done by using either or both. Right.
Right. Well,
there's nothing wrong with a good healthy competition. Sometimes it turns ugly, but that can motivate people, and collaboration is important as well.
Well, speaking of ugly, they also talk a bit about, you know,
Cook,
you know, Robert, or was it Hook or Cook or
wait, Hook.
Yeah. Hook. Robert Hook. Right. And he didn't like Isaac Newton. Obviously, when Isaac Newton was a boy, he cut off Hook's hand and fed it to a crocodile. And ever since then, they were bitter enemies.
Well, Hook didn't start off as kind of the villain. It was near the end when he contested that he had discovered, was it the laws of motion or the inverse square law?
Well, Hook's law, the law of elasticity. And I do remember in my astronomy class, I do remember one of the early attempts to try and understand the motion of the planets was using Hook's law, and it just didn't work. They just couldn't find a way to make the math work.
Right.
Now, even though we are still kind of in that era of omens and bad, you know, portents from the comments, I did like that, you know, you had the Royal Society of London, and they were doing the best they could to try and figure this stuff out scientifically. It's just at that time they just didn't have the math to do it.
Yeah.
And despite their best efforts, they couldn't figure out a way to do it. And it was really, you know, Ollie was like, well, there's this mathematician, and maybe we'll go see if he could do it. And something I didn't know, Chalmers, do you know if this is accurate? Like, whenever like he meets Isaac Newton and he asks him about, you know, he tells him, like, look, we've got this problem. We all agree that there's some kind of force that's controlling the motion of the planets. We just can't figure it out. And Isaac Newton is like, I solved that 5 years ago here. Did he really just have it for 5 years of sitting?
I'm not sure. Possible. He spent.
That's ridiculous. So Newton, something so important.
Spent a lot of time outside of academic education.
right,
just sort of sitting around thinking and writing and accumulating work. So it's possible, you know, he could have come up. It's hard to know when the seeds of a lot of his ideas might have been planted.
Yeah,
right.
Because he was reclusive and he worked by himself, kind of obsessively.
As a side note, I when I hear about scientists like that, it's easy for us from our vantage point to think how great they were. But I don't know if I don't know if that's a good life, you know. To okay, sure, you leave things for posterity. And obviously, in the case of Sir Isaac Newton, you know, these are things that are the springboard for an incredible number of discoveries and activities. There's a segment in this episode of The Cosmos, which, you know, is a montage of all the things that NASA has done.
Right. Just using his laws of motion. Right.
And so, you know, I mean, it's obviously going to be controversial for someone like me to say that maybe he shouldn't have lived that way because it wouldn't have resulted in these discoveries. But I don't know. I think I'm still going to say it. Maybe he shouldn't have lived that way. I don't know that it's a – even if you do produce great things for other people, I wouldn't think that that's a good way to live.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, like, he obviously seemed like he had some, you know, emotional – issues.
Yeah. Father dead from birth.
Right.
Mother left him for what, about 10 years when he was very, very young.
Right. And obviously, like, you know, after he had that kind of falling out publicly with Hook, you know, over like who discovered, like, it was, I think, some kind of explanations for how light works.
Right.
He really kind of disappeared. We kind of just disappeared totally.
Right.
I did like how the episode, they also highlighted that, you know, Isaac Newton did believe some kind of crazy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was into alchemy. Pretty big,
mm-hmm.
You know, and, he, I was and the Bible code.
I was surprised about his interest in numerology. That's another gap in my knowledge. I don't remember that, or I didn't remember that. And apparently he tried to work out, you know, biblical prophecies for return of Christ and wasn't able to work it out.
And he was kind of a religious rogue and really private about his ideas, but his ideas were not reflective of the established religious ideology of the time.
Right.
No. But that's what was cool about the Royal Society of London. I liked their Latin motto, the you know, in nubis in verba, the see for yourself
right.
mentality. That was kind of pushing pushing boundaries at that time. That kind of
why mentality. Isn't that a bumper sticker?
It should be.
Yeah. That should be like the new skeptics bumper sticker.
Right.
You know, what is it? Marines have Semper Fidelis. That should be the skeptic's new motto.
We're doing it.
Okay.
No, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, at the time, even though Robert Hooke is kind of, you know, presented as a bit of a bastard, he was also incredibly smart. And some of the stuff that he did, they highlighted. I didn't realize he was the one who discovered the cell.
Yeah.
And it's still called that.
Right, but I, if I'm not mistaken, and Chalmer, you can correct me if you remember this, but I believe that the reason why he called it the cell is because at that level of magnification, he saw these spaces and didn't see anything in them. And so he thought, like prison cells, they're just these like empty rooms where not a whole lot is going on.
Right, and I think he was looking at something like sponge or something like that. Something with
cork. Cork, they said.
Cork, it was cork, yeah.
Yeah.
So with cork, the actual the cell wall can be maintained while the innards go away.
Right.
And so they may have actually been empty.
Right. Oh, yeah. But it's just funny that word that we take for granted now as being this ultra complicated, you know, mini city, the cell, and really the building block functionally of living things.
Yeah.
Is named that because they thought that nothing was going on in there. it's perverse. The show does talk about Haley at this time as well.
Yeah, this is a counter to the kind of sad life seemingly that Isaac Newton may have lived. Sounds like you know, it said that Haley had parents who his father encouraged him and bought him to scientific and funded his expeditions. And I had no idea he did so much insane stuff.
So, really, the concept of science and its rigorous application at this point was not really that well developed, right? I mean, he's working around and maybe a little after the same time as people like Descartes and this is sort of in the midst of the Enlightenment era, right?
Kind of right, kind of right in the middle. I mean, this was, I think, the 1600s, I believe.
Let's look it up.
Yeah, and one of the first cool things that I learned that he did, it says that, I made a note here. He
18th century.
Yeah.
So a little bit later than in that time period.
Well, it said that Halley made the first accurate star map of the Southern Hemisphere.
Right. That was what I have my notes is kind of your first introduction to Halley. That the show is going the direction of showing that this guy is known for a lot more than just the comet.
Well, he should be. And he is known for, like, he did all this cool stuff, but it's kind of sad that I don't think a lot of people know about
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know about this much stuff. And he did a lot of insane stuff. I made notes of some of the other things that he did in his life. He mapped the Earth's magnetic fields.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that you could do that back then. I just didn't realize you can do that back then. I guess they must have had, obviously, magnetic compasses then, because how else would you do it?
Well, I don't know that it would be a magnetic compass. It would just be something measuring magnetic strength, right?
Yeah, I guess. And it says he invented the idea of a weather map, and that today we still use his symbols on that map.
Huh.
He worked on deep-sea diving bells, which I did not know that they had back then. He also kind of created, like, population density statistics, it said. I mean, like, insane stuff. I had no idea he did so much cool stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of jealous because they live in a time where when they discover these new mathematical approaches, they essentially have an open playing field with no competition.
Yeah.
They have these new tools and theories and a world that's completely devoid of their application so far.
Doesn't that sometimes piss you off, Chalmer?
A little bit.
That, like, they got to live in a time period where you really could use your mind to make just an absolute breakthrough. Now it's extremely difficult to make any progress in science that isn't just incremental and therefore obscure to the field, you know?
Right. Well, and the age of the lone genius is kind of dying out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These kinds of discoveries, these big leaps, are requiring multidisciplinary teams working together on a variety of minutiae.
Yeah.
And so it's the Einsteins of the world are going to disappear, I think, over time.
Well, I mean, they'll still be around. They just won't be famous.
Right. Right. Speaking of, like, inventing math, for anyone listening here.
Inventing math.
Well, look,
the Greeks invented. No, the Greeks didn't invent math. They invented thinking.
But, like, new math, though. I mean, for anyone out there who's ever taken, like, high school pre-calc or calculus and just thought, I'd really like to punch the person who made this up in the face. That's Isaac Newton. And he did it because Halley came to him and said, can you tell us how the planets orbit the sun? And he said, sure, let me get back to you on that.
Yeah.
And then he came back and said, sorry, it took so long. I had to invent calculus.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't exist.
I actually, when I was watching Cosmos and Laura was around, I paused it. It's funny. I realized that when I watch Cosmos, it's kind of like, for me, watching a sport, because I, will have times that I'm, like, yelling at the screen, things like that. And so I paused it, and she was cooking or something, and I said, you know anything about Isaac Newton, babe? And she goes, well, tell me something. I said, yeah. So he was so smart that in order to figure out the orbits of the planets, he couldn't initially do the math, so he invented calculus to do it.
That's dedication.
Right. And she was just like, really?
Right.
Yeah.
People don't,
it's easy in our modern age not to realize that this stuff hasn't always been there in some sense, but yeah.
Part of me wants to go through the sick exercise of looking at the math involved.
Part of me does too.
See why you can't do it without calculus, because I'm a little skeptical of the value of some of the math that we end up teaching people. I think that math might be overemphasized in education, and I'm sure that might irritate people once I actually get a little bit more into science education. But I think that there are too many people taking these higher level math courses, and they're just not useful at all to what they do. But obviously, they are useful.
Right. This one was super useful. I mean, what I said before this, we kind of lived in a world that was kind of controlled by what people called, like, the idea of master clockmaker for God.
Right. Right.
And it was just kind of like, well, the planets are going around because it seems like that's just the way they do it.
Right. God did it was the ultimate algebraic expression to solve whatever you needed.
And Neil says, like, we really couldn't blame them.
Sure.
They were really trying the best they could. And when they were making these observations, none of the math they had, none of the tools they had worked.
Right.
There was seemingly no other explanation. And that's one of the important things here, is that this is transition here,
right,
really into, like, the modern science age.
Right.
And even though, like, Isaac Newton's laws of motion aren't perfect for describing how the universe work as far as gravity and that sort of thing, the theory of gravity, they still work today. And those are still the primary things they use whenever we look at, like, you know, the motions of other galaxies.
Yeah, yeah.
These laws work.
Right.
And that was the first time.
It certainly indicates the regularity of these motions, such that you don't need an individual to maintain them. That is the key, right?
Right. That's really the key right there.
As a side note, it's a very abstract question, and maybe it's one that we'll pick up in another episode. But I'm uncomfortable with the term mathematical explanation. I've run into that in my physics class, actually. I've asked my physics instructor a few questions. And right now I'm taking conceptual physics, so we're not emphasizing math. We're looking at the concepts. And there have been several times that she has refused to answer me and has basically said, well, you know, if you look at this at a deeper level, you'll see that the math actually explains this for you. And I'm not sure I like that kind of answer. I'm not sure math can explain anything.
It makes me uncomfortable, too, a little bit with that sort of thing. Chalmer, how do you feel about that sort of thing? As a scientist, you probably use math all the time, I imagine.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd thing to say. For the most part, mathematics is a derived to be reflective of the way things behave.
Exactly. So it can't be an explanation. It's a different meaning of the word explanation.
Now, sometimes you can take a mathematical model derived from something and play with it and make predictions. But that's not the same as explaining them. You know what I mean?
Right.
So yeah, it's a weird way to refer to it.
Yeah, I don't really like that. That seems to me to be a shell game.
Maybe somewhere in like computer programming or something like that.
Have to think about it some more. We'll have to save that for another episode. But yeah, I think where I want to leave this is just, you know, these mathematical calculations, in that they determine a regularity, is a different way of explaining something. It's explaining it such that this is a detailed map or model of how these things work. It's not an explanation of why they work this way, but this is a detailed model of their regularity.
Of like how something happens and the predictive qualities of it are probably what makes it. I mean, it just works.
Right.
And this is one of the things that it's funny. Like Neil says, perhaps the only thing that Holly didn't actually do was to discover a comet.
By the way, you keep saying Holly. Is it pronounced Haley or
Holly? I've always pronounced it Haley before, but I thought I heard Neil saying Holly. So I don't know how to say it.
Chalmers said Haley. Haley is all what I've always heard.
We'll call it Haley then. We'll go
I think
Haley.
I'm so used to hearing it that's – I didn't even notice it being pronounced differently.
Halling? Is it Halley?
Something like that. I don't know.
Let's just pepper them all use all different pronunciations, and we'll get it right.
I think both work.
One third of the
Haley is always how I heard it described. I thought it was spelled differently too because of that. But
yeah.
One thing I find fascinating about a lot of this, you know, classical science, is when you look at what people like Newton came up with, and you look at his laws of motion, they seem really straightforward. And in retrospect, sometimes I think, how the hell did it take that long?
I made a note of that. It's crazy that it took so long to come up with that. Well, what's interesting to me is like he was a really smart guy, but there must have been other smart people throughout history who just couldn't put it together.
Yeah, see,
but
I think
all great
I understand.
Discoveries are this way.
But I think I understand why you think that. It's because you live in the modern world.
Exactly.
So from the earliest age of going to school, you go to kindergarten, there's probably some placard somewhere or some cartoon or poster on the wall that shows the planets. At some point that was new, and that's fairly recent that happened. Before then, all people were looking at were these very slow-moving dots in the sky.
Yeah.
And it was not general knowledge that these things were in the orbits that they were the size objects that they were these worlds. you know, I mean, before Galileo, people thought that these objects might be just pinholes in the sphere, right?
Right.
Or what? Weren't really sure what kinds of objects, if anything, that they were. Never mind that they were moving. So, yeah, I think that we take that for granted because of the collective knowledge that we just, you know, see around us.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and no, that makes sense. You know, although it is what you just said makes me reflect even more on it, where it's like kind of amazing then that someone like Isaac Newton,
yeah,
in the time,
real vision.
Right, in a time where you look up and people are like, you know, these are ill omens and these are, you know, right, just points of light that we don't even know about. And right, from that, like the idea that you would correlate that to, instead, I think there are like mathematical laws that might explain this. Mm-hmm. That to me is awesome. Like, yeah. I don't think I would ever have been like, I think we can explain this with math.
Right.
There must be some kind of way that it all fits. I mean, that sort of thing is pretty revolutionary, I think.
Yeah.
Well, and even now, explaining gravity is itself kind of an odd thing. I mean, even
As we said,
relativity
before,
doesn't quite make it there.
Exactly, as we
with
said,
the curvature of space time, that's not quite complete.
No, we live in a time that we know that none of our models of gravity are correct.
Right. So.
They all work to certain degrees.
I keep waiting for the folks at CERN to have spawned some breakthrough in gravity, and that I believe is, you know, that should be coming along at some point, right?
Well, they already isolated the Higgs boson, didn't they?
Right.
Yeah, which is huge.
And I think that was a big step towards linking a lot of theoretical quirkiness together.
Right, but I'm waiting for it to become textbook worthy. Right.
Yeah.
But, okay, this is now the right understanding of gravitation generally.
Yeah.
Usually forces involve an exchange of particles.
And yeah.
Gravity has not in the past been this. Now, the Higgs boson, is that the gravity particle? I don't remember.
It's the particle that gives you mass, that gives things mass.
It grants things mass.
I think so. It might also be the graviton.
It's synonymous with the graviton?
You learn in school about protons, neutrons, and electrons, but then you get into like the fundamental particles and
quarks and stuff like that.
You're just kind of like, whoa.
Yeah,
that's a lot of stuff. Very deep.
Yeah. So let's see.
I've always heard people say that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, then you don't understand quantum mechanics.
Oh, the graviton is the hypothetical elementary particle that mediates the force of gravitation in the framework of quantum field theory.
Right.
Qua?
So I guess the Higgs boson is not the graviton.
Yeah, I thought there was a difference.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure there is. It is a boson.
I don't know. I just know that sometimes Picard would say, we need a tachyon burst off the port. Angle to the deflector shield.
Well, we're doing a little bit of sausage making on this episode, but I like it anyways. I don't care. We don't know everything. Not even close.
Well, that's what's exciting about it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's also so cool that so you know, we know that obviously Newton's laws of motion aren't complete as far as like an explanatory thing for gravity, but they still do work to describe motion.
Right.
You know, and everything that you see, that kind of stuff is just awesome to me. And like, even like the theory of relativity, like, even though we know that it's not the correct one, it still kind of works for certain observations. And that's neat to me.
These are models.
Right.
Right.
Norm, I want to read something to you real quick.
Please.
Unambiguous detection of individual gravitons, although not fundamentally impossible, is impossible with any physically reasonable detector.
Right.
The reason is the low cross-section for the interaction of gravitons with matter. A detector the mass of Jupiter at 100% efficiency placed in close orbit around a neutron star would only be expected to observe one graviton every 10 years.
Jesus.
What?
There's some of that math for you, Norm, that probably tells us that.
I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of melts my brain a little bit when I try and wrap it around that.
Because obviously the objects are involved in a significant gravitational tete-a-tete.
if you will.
I don't understand that. That sounds to me like a statement that is summarizing something that they've discovered mathematically.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big problems I have with quantum mechanics in general, is that almost all of the statements that come out of quantum mechanics are not observational. They are implications of doing the math. That's why it's called quantum mechanics.
Yeah. Well, not quantum mechanics was the one subject in chemistry that I never really got.
Right.
I know there's that joke that if you think you understand it, you don't. But yeah, my catch up was the fact that the way in which evidence and theory and observation are drawn together to present concepts is completely different than all previous forms of chemistry.
Yeah, so, and that makes me uncomfortable with the whole thing. I know it very well might sound ignorant, and I'm okay with that because I don't claim to understand it very well. But whenever I run into quantum mechanics, I always in my head put an asterisk by every statement. Because the sense quantum mechanics is so messed up, I kind of feel in my gut that that's a sign that we don't really understand what's going on.
Well, we don't, and who knows if we will.
And I kind of suspect that it would be replaced. But I'm sure that that's a bias toward elegance and simplicity. You're right,
but don't feel bad about that, because you know who else felt that way? Einstein.
Oh, really?
He hated the idea. Like, he accidentally discovered what would probably be quantum mechanics and was like, I don't like this, and didn't want to even think about it.
Right.
Because I think one of his things he didn't like about it was that it seemed ineloquent, and he was like, I don't even want to go there.
Yeah.
So people talk about his theories. Like, he kind of predicted quantum mechanics even though he didn't want to go there and talk about it because he was uncomfortable with the idea that might be out there.
There's a bias toward, you know, the idea that our logic applies to the universe. So, for example, the law of non-contradiction, that's big to philosophers, and this Aristotelian law, a law of thought.
Oh, yeah. That, self-identity and all that.
Right. That quantum mechanics seems to violate, and so from a person like me, that is a sign that, well, obviously that can't be correct.
Right. Well, I think it makes everyone uncomfortable. The idea, I mean, and sometimes physicists talk about this. Lawrence Krauss talks about it in his book, what was it called? His newest book where he talks about how the universe could have come from nothing.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And that makes people uncomfortable because it seems like it goes against – well, it's just one of those things where you're like, well, how could you get something from nothing? And it's what everyone says.
Right.
And
nothing plus nothing means nothing.
Stenger right. does this too.
All right. Well, he says, you know, like the math suggests that if you have nothing, you'll always get something. And you'd be more surprised if you got nothing from nothing. Like, it seems like if you have nothing, something will always happen. And it makes you kind of go, what?
Nature abhors a vacuum.
This is one of those times where I wish that we kind of had like a regular radio show with buttons that made weird sounds. I'll put in a weird sound right now, because now the conversation has gotten delightfully weird.
Like the sound of a car crashing into a wall is my understanding. Just like stops about this stuff.
We'll edit it in post.
Right. Yeah. So some of those. Whenever I'm just not very good at math. Never have been. I understand a lot of the concepts of it, and I can wrap my head around all the concepts. When it comes to actually doing it, I'm just not very good at math. So whenever you get into like stuff like, you know, some pretty extreme physics and then quantum mechanics
to relate what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that whatever the sort of final framework theory for quantum mechanics is, that it probably won't be that far off from what we currently have, given its capacity and application and predictive capacity. A lot of the weirdness may be indicative of weaknesses in the theory, but the theory itself overall seems it's got to be much closer than anything we had before.
Hey,
that makes sense.
Yay, we just found something that Chalmer and I disagree about, which
really?
Is nice. Yes, I don't agree. To me, when I read about the double slit experiments and things like that,
oh yeah,
I just think this is a sign that we don't understand light and that the photon might not be real. That it might not actually be photons. Photon might be a model, and that this is going to get replaced by a better model or something like that.
I just know that Schroeder's cat means that my cat is alive and dead at the same time.
Yeah. Speaking of all this, I have in my notes that Isaac Newton was a lousy student.
He was. Like I said, he did a lot of his greatest work outside of academia, sitting alone in isolation and moping and
right. I had the thought that this should not be used as a license to be okay with being a lousy student now.
Right.
True.
Because the vast majority of people, you know, the youngsters who are in school, who are lousy students, it's not because they're too smart.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's because of other things, probably behavioral issues or whatever.
Well, even Einstein failed math.
He did?
Well, yeah.
Huh.
Is that, is that an urban legend?
Maybe it is an urban legend. I've always heard that. I've always heard that he was lousy at math as a child.
Chalmer, when I point at you, that's when you look things up.
Right.
Wait, no, he's remote. He can't see
you. I can't see you.
Oh, well, I mean, he's our resident scientist. So if Chalmers says it's not true, then it's not true.
It was a line from Moneyball anyways. I'm just full of movie lines.
Yeah.
Well, we see that pattern a lot with these guys, famous scientists dropping out of school. And it kind of makes sense. If there's kind of the seeds of a disagreement in the current paradigms that they feel or see, it makes sense that they would have trouble grasping. And then later contributing. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. They're too uncool for school.
Yeah.
And it might
so
just
like
be.
None of us get physics. So like we're going to shake
maybe
the system
up. Maybe there is an urban legend about Einstein. I always wonder, like, the whole apple falling on Newton's head. Was that an urban legend too, do you think?
Oh, I got something like that.
Right. Well, it's not an urban legend, but it is considered apocryphal or something like a legend. Like, it might have happened. He did, I believe, have a relative who had a large orchard, or maybe on his own land he had an orchard. And so it's plausible, but there's no actual evidence that says that.
Well, there's a funny Far Side comic, and it's all these scientists who are sitting out reading books underneath apple trees, and there's apples falling all around these scientists, and then Isaac Newton is sitting underneath a tree with a gigantic apple, like the size of, like, you know, a dog or something hanging over his head.
By the way, I just found this. Albert Einstein did not fail mathematics in school.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Upon seeing a column making this claim, Einstein said, "I never failed in mathematics. Before I was 15, I had mastered differential and integral calculus." That's a scientist's way of saying, fuck you.
Right.
Yeah.
You would have to in order to master that at 15?
That makes me hate him even more.
Right.
No, I don't hate him.
Well, it was interesting, like you know, he, like, a lot of these people who are geniuses like that, like how early on they master these things.
Yeah.
I mean, Isaac Newton was like, what, like in his early 20s whenever Halley found him.
Yeah. But let's talk about Newton trying to publish via the Royal Society. I want to make sure we don't miss that point. Halley was trying to get Newton's work published, and he couldn't initially. And do you guys remember why?
Because they blew all their money on, what was it, the history of fish.
They were banking on that that fish book doing well.
Right. So, you know, let's forget the idea that it was an unwise investment. What I took away from this was science funding really matters.
Yeah.
One of the things, well, you talked earlier about the fact that this great master work in science might not have happened.
Yeah.
One of the big reasons why it might not have happened was because the Royal Society was poor at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And it kind of makes sense for at the time, it's almost excusable for back then because science hadn't really done much yet.
Right.
You know, they're still starting to discover stuff and do stuff. Today, it's kind of inexcusable, I think,
right.
the lack of science funding that we do. But it's borderline irresponsible. But,
yeah.
You know, back then, it kind of makes sense. And it says that Halley funded it himself, ultimately.
And I was a little fuzzy on how that worked because Halley was getting paid in the fish book.
And I don't understand. How does that work as a salary? What do you do with that book? Sell it himself then?
Sell it later? I mean, it's a commodity.
Yeah.
I didn't really get that.
I have the book
for
open
firewood?
Right now.
I don't know.
I'm looking at it.
What book? The fish book?
The history of fish.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean on your computer?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you actually had the book.
He has a signed first edition.
We're not – okay, let's explain to listeners.
A real book.
Chalmer is remote, so we can't see what he's doing. So when Chalmer, you say I have the book right now, I assume you mean you have the book.
Yeah.
Is the distinction really important?
Yes.
That is a
very, very old book. I would be freaked out if you had a 120-year-old book from the Royal Society, copy on you. That would be cool. I would like to see that.
And probably illegal, so we might want to edit this part out.
I'm going to now see if it's available on eBay. You guys continue the conversation.
Well, I imagine at some point Haley had so many he just didn't know what to do with. So everyone for Christmas got that book re-gifted to them.
Are you looking it up on eBay?
I am looking it up on eBay right now. I'm looking up the Royal Society History of Fish on eBay.
An original, mind you.
I don't see it.
Dang it.
It's not there.
Nobody's selling it?
No, nobody's selling it. I will do more research later. No, I mean, you know, I mean, it's almost cliche to mention this, but think about our military budget. And, you know, I'm not as cynical as a lot of liberals, quote unquote, I'll use that term, you know, air quotes, a lot of liberals regarding military spending, because military spending is similar to spending on NASA in that it's not just funding, you know, technology for war. You end up funding all kinds of technologies because it's really a series of engineering projects.
Yeah.
But that being said, there is a significant difference between engineering and science.
Oh, yeah.
And we are not funding science enough in the most economically powerful nation on the planet. The science budget is way too small. And, absolutely. And the science budget is conspicuously small in things that have conflicts with religion, such as stem cell research. And research into, you know, funding for archaeology, things like that. These things are not properly funded. People who are doing them are always, it seems to me, whenever I hear about them, they're always, you know, only able to fund a project for a year or even months, because they don't know where their next funding source is going to come from. And that's no way to do research.
No.
Right? If you're going to have a substantive research project, you need to have some regular funding. And you hear about other countries who are funding their sciences. They don't have the resources, both intellectual and economic and even sometimes technological, as we do. And they fund science better than we. So yeah. I don't know. I mean, this is to me a sign of the culture clash in this nation, that people don't understand science. They're somewhat skeptical of it. They might flat out deny it, and that ends up trickling down. It makes sense that it would, because this is a representative democracy. Right. So a government reflects some of the ills of the people. That it doesn't get funded enough.
No,
I'm sure we can find plenty of examples of bills to fund science that are killed.
Probably,
and you know, probably can killed by. People who are cynics about the value of science or even science deniers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think it's easy politically to call science a bit of a pork barrel project.
Yeah.
And
where you don't see a practical benefit.
Well, because there's not one immediately. And I think it's kind of accurate probably to say it, I think. I mean, I hate to say that, but, you know, if someone's like, listen, I need funds.
Where's the practical benefit of some of these weapons that we make? Again, they might foster other technologies, but there's no guarantee that they will.
Well, here's the thing. Now we're going to have Amazon drones, so I accept your apology, okay?
And you know what? Guess what? Science discoveries have the same thing.
Look, I'm one of the cynics you were talking about when it comes to the military budget. Okay, sure. Fucking cut it in half and give it the rest of it to science.
Yeah, and there are always efforts to try to do that. I believe that right now we're working on cutting the military budget fairly significantly,
Half. Well, what's funny is, like, you know, some people talk about how you have the military saying, like, please don't order any more tanks. We just don't need – we don't need fucking tanks. Like if we made a list of everything we need, tanks was not on that list. And then they're like, good news, everybody. You know, we just ordered 70,000 new tanks to be built, which will go park in Arizona for the rest of eternity. Until, like, you know, it's like an excellent just example of, like, you know, the second law of thermodynamics, this entropy happening in front of you, just sitting there rusting away in the desert. So, yeah.
If we cut the military budget in half, I feel like we could build like a cat circus on the moon. Just it's so much money compared to what we currently have in NASA.
Let's even do something like just end the war on drugs and just put that money towards science. Do something.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I just found a copy of Historia Piscium. That is the book.
Yes.
And it is available in paperback on eBay for $35. Something tells me that that is not an original copy. I'm pretty sure that's not.
Adjusted for inflation.
No, it was worth even less originally. It's gone up like 300% in value.
Right. And Haley was like, I can't believe it's worth that much.
Oh, man. Well, what was next on the episode? So I think we've already talked about the fact that the work that these guys were doing was related to our overall view of the world and helped shape the scientific method, its ability to predict things, Haley being able to predict the next coming of the comet was another
step. And that's why it's named after him.
Right. And, you know, Newton's laws. That must have
felt really good when it showed up.
Although he wasn't there to see it. It was like 50 years later.
Periodicity 70-something years?
It's about 76 years, something like that. But he had said, like, you know, this thing, if I'm right, will be back in this orientation in the sky from this direction in 50 years. Right.
That would be like the ultimate told you so.
Right.
I feel bad for him.
I don't know that the episode mentioned whether he was around to see it.
Yeah, I don't think it said whether or not he was dead for it. Probably.
I don't think he saw it initially. I think he was using records, right?
Right.
Well, he saw it when he was a child.
Right.
So that means that he might have seen it because he lived it. No, he probably just didn't.
Because he died at 84, they said?
Something like that.
And which is, you know, which also for back then, that's impressive. That's an impressive lifespan. And, yeah, I mean, they said that he began to seek out all accounts of these comets, you know, like historical accounts of it. And he discovered, I think, that a lot of these comet sightings were the same one.
Yeah, Haley did not live to see the return of his comet. So Nick is right.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
No, but there's a chance, though, that I mean, I was alive when it was here last, although I didn't know it. We might be alive when it comes back, maybe. So. When did they say the next time it's going to be?
They said 50 years.
I think so.
What, from now?
Yeah. It was about like 50, 20 years ago that it came, right?
Yeah.
So you guys might. I probably won't.
Well, not that attitude.
Well, that would make me 96, which that's pushing it.
So
that's aiming high.
I figure if I live to 80, I'm doing real good.
This is why.
As a dude, you know, guys, we don't live as long.
Well, look what we have to put up with, really. The poor white man. The plight of us.
I have too much indulgence.
Oh, no. It's terrible.
And I just hope that, you know, by that time, at some point, we'll just figure out a way to cut the military budget, and then science will figure it out, and I'll get to live longer. That's what I need them to do.
Yeah.
Just digitize my brain.
So the theme being developed in the episode was the power of scientific method to predict and create models that allow you to do that prediction, and that itself is part of the scientific method as demonstrated with Haley. And then a modern example was given with the fact that we can now predict using similar kinds of methods, just on a bigger scale. We can now predict that Andromeda is on a collision course basically with the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah.
So, and there's no reason to be afraid of it because of the distances. Well,
mark
of the stars.
Your calendars. If you're around in like 6 billion years,
something like that.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, put that in your Outlook appointments so that you don't miss it.
An Outlook reminder in 6 billion years.
Bing!
Or whatever it was.
Dismiss. So this is something that is a long range prediction. And what's interesting is that we see you can observe galaxies that are mixed now. Yeah. We observe so many different galaxies.
We see merging galaxies.
That's right.
Out there.
And so we're one of them. And in fact, I read that the majority, though I don't know how big of a majority, but the majority of galaxies are paired or in a three-way.
With, yeah, they tend other to cluster.
Yeah.
Well, we're in the Virgo orgy, if you will.
So if you've seen that big map, it tends to be thin tendrils that converge on – it almost looks like neurons where they converge into a dense pack and then spread out into thin tendrils into other concentrations. But yeah, they – well, it's just like they've done some experiments on the space station where they're looking at particles of sand and water to see how they – behave when they're evenly dispersed in water and zero gravity, and I think they form that same sort of network and converge on each other.
They start clumping together too.
Huh.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's interesting to see that sort of thing.
We didn't do it, but we saw an experiment in my physics class where you can actually measure the force of gravity, where you can get a heavy ball and a small object and or another object. And you can measure the weight, the pull of that object gravitationally to the Earth. That's weight. And then you can put the heavy ball underneath it and measure it again, and you can actually measure a difference.
Yeah.
So I guess we have accurate enough scales now that we can measure just directly right there in front of you the force of gravity.
Well, not only that, you can use the laws of motion to weigh a galaxy. You look at its orbit. So we know how much Andromeda weighs, and you can look up, and we know it's coming. It's coming right at us.
It's a calculation. Yeah.
You can measure the force of gravity if you can travel, or if you just measure the acceleration of the object.
Yeah. Was that something that came from Newton's laws of motion?
You mean by recording the time?
Yeah. So determining the acceleration by performing, a standard drop length.
Right.
According to time it takes to drive.
But in the very short amount of time that you have that is a more impractical experiment than just measuring the pull of gravity and the difference between the pull of gravity toward the Earth and the pull of gravity toward the Earth plus a heavy object underneath you.
Yeah.
Apparently. Because, you can buy or some – like high school labs will have equipment that will allow you to actually measure this.
Yeah.
And the pull of gravity is not ubiquitous across the globe. The gravity maps kind of depict, where there's concentrations of matter and the way the Earth is shaped.
I just didn't like the way you said it. It made it sound like there were places where there was no gravity. And I would like to go to those. You mean it's weaker in some places than others, and that seems obvious to me, right? If you're on top of if you're on top of Mount Everest, you've got more mass directly underneath you, but you're also further away from the center, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's not quite intuitive as to how it distributes itself.
Right,
but,
right.
Yeah.
If you're below a particularly dense glob.
So the equator, the Earth is an oblate spheroid.
Right.
More gravity at the equator than at the poles, but then – there's topographical differences, and there's also differences in the composition in the area that can affect gravity. So it's
Chalmer. He just
depends.
He just wanted to say oblate spheroid.
Me too. That's why I took away from that.
Yeah. I like the word oblate. I'm hoping someday I can use it somewhere else because it hasn't occurred to me to use it yet.
Well, if you barely, instead of getting into a full on accident, you try to veer so that you don't hit the person directly head on. You can say that you made an oblation.
Well,
I think instead of gassy, I'm going to say oblated.
Mm. Well, Chalmer, if someone asks you to describe your location, you could be like, I'm driving. I'm on a oblate spheroid. there's trees.
Have we talked about everything on this episode?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there are a couple of things that we missed, but I don't know that we need to cover absolutely everything.
No, and I love the way the episode closed with the dance of the two galaxies merging together.
No, there is one thing that I wanted to talk about. It was earlier in the episode. We kind of glossed over it. There was a reference to coffee houses in the episode.
Oh, I did make a note of that. And I was like, who would have thought back then the hipsters were right?
Yeah, well, so the point in the episode is that coffee houses were kind of little havens of democracy because you know, you could go in there and you didn't have to give up your seat to someone who was wealthy or powerful. Hey, they got to find their own frickin' seat.
Right.
And people can mix and talk about things freely. And in the caffeinated environment, ideas are flowing a little quicker.
Right.
And I got to say that this is underrated. This is something that I'm not sure at our online society is taking advantage of as much as it used to. Meeting our friends and people to talk in coffee houses, you can have some really interesting conversations and you can get ideas going, help each other out. Again, part of the scientific method and just the scientific attitude about life is that it's not only – it's a blend of competition and collaboration.
Well, how cool would it be just to hang out with Neil in a coffee house?
Yeah.
Like in the episode there?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I'm sure whenever Haley was there, they're like, listen, you can't pay us in History of Fish. It's just it's like, that's all I've got.
You know what maybe we should do just to honor this episode is we should do the podcast in a coffee house. We could, there are a couple of coffee houses that have rooms. We could hear have the bustle of people coming and going around us. And I don't know. Maybe that's dorky, but I would have fun doing that.
We'll just record those ambient noises and pipe them in.
We'll just synthesized coffee house.
We have a coffee right now, so.
Well, you could Google right now, coffee house MP3 sounds.
Right.
Oh, geez.
The sound of hipsters.
Yeah, I know.
I also have a little reference here that Hook, being the kind of person that was kind of a polymath on his own, did a lot of different things. He also wrote about pot. Basically wrote that it was nothing to be terribly afraid of.
It's like except for laughter or something like that.
Right, that it's – yeah. And, you know, I'm glad that, you know, I, newsflash, we're doing this recording from Colorado. I'm glad that as a society we are starting to come around to this not being the crazy danger that it's been thought or published.
Pot you end up smoking now is not the pot he smoked.
No,
by
that's
a long
true.
Stretch.
That's true.
We have awesome stuff. No, that kind of goes back to what you just said. Kind of goes back to what this episode is about: when knowledge conquers fear,
right?
And we're beginning to learn more, and people are actually beginning to absorb more about the, you know, the truth of these sort of things. And I think that's one of the important things about science is we're always kind of moving in this perspective.
Yep,
you know, from a position of, you know, ignorance towards knowledge.
Yep.
And it's okay.
I'm not afraid.
You will be. I think that'll about do it for us here. So, you know, I think for all of you out there in podcast land, we want to always make sure that we tell you to, you know, nubus in verba, which is just a fancy way of saying think responsibly.